The other thing, and I always refer back to my CSO at the time, Bill Burke, where a very experienced person, in the way I told him, listen, man, we're not in a candy store. You know, we could all look around and get nice, big, bright eyes and look, and now we could do this, we could do that. But man, the money is on hemoglobinopathy. Yes, we need to focus and execute on that, at least during the early years. And that's what we did.
Hey, Philip here. Welcome to the sixth episode of the Flood Bio Show, where I interview the best Europeans in biotech to help you grow. Today, I'm in Zug, just next to Zurich, to talk with Roger Novak, who is one of the co-founders and the chairman of CRISPR Therapeutics. And Roger is really one of the few Europeans who made it really big globally in biotech. We had our first chat on stage in 2016, and it's great to be able to talk with him again today. We will talk about bringing the first CRISPR drug to the market, almost there, and why he thinks everything is broken in biotech in Europe except science. So let's head to the meeting room and talk with him. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to be in Zurich. It's quite hot.
Yeah, I was really excited.
Yeah, okay. You have somewhere to see. So yeah, I mean, for today, I think we have a lot of topics to cover, or we could cover. But I wanted to start with the CRISPR drugs and bringing the first one to the market. It's I think, really close, supposed to be reviewed, I think, December, end of this year for one indication, and you have founded the company that is behind it. And I think my question is, how did you manage to go faster than everyone else in this space?
Oh, okay. So the nice answer, or the not so nice answer? No, I mean, I think it's a good question maybe to start. Now, it's 10 years ago. So when we when I got introduced to the CRISPR technology, I think one of the very first things was really the question, how do you translate this? So you have something in a really innovative, everybody or almost everybody starts to work on it. Many people get excited. But then the big question is, okay, how do you really make sure that you can translate this into some kind of drug? Yeah. And I think there were two, three elements to this, which I think are not only applicable to CRISPR and the story, but maybe in general. So the very first is we thought, hey, we need to understand the technology relatively well, or at least better than what we read, you know, from academic scientific publications. And once we have understood this a little better, we also understood very quickly where are the advantages at that stage of the technology and where are the disadvantages. Yes. And so we said, okay, we need to make sure that we make use of what this technology is really good at. Yeah. And everything else, so that we park this, but, you know, we don't put an emphasis on that at the beginning. So in the end, keep it simple.
You have an example on that?
Yeah, the example is relatively easy. You know, people were excited in two ways. You know, they were excited that you can knock down something by having a double-stranded DNA cut, which then gets repaired. And during that repair, you have some mistakes. And with that, you get your knockdown. And obviously, the other approach is that you insert a DNA template with whatever kind of sequence you're intending to put into the DNA. The second one, even today, 10 years later, is still a challenge for various reasons. And we understood this, and I think others understood this also as well very early on, that the knockdown is easier. But I think what we also did is then we thought more from a translational perspective about how do you make use of this. So we really ignored the insertion part and said, okay, so if we now knock something out, how can we do this? And there's a second problem, which was very clear that time and still is a big challenge for our field, and that was the delivery aspect. So we, at the time in particular, yes, you know, we knew about mRNA delivery and LNPs and AAV and pretty much what we know today. Yeah. I mean, today I think the field is much more sophisticated, yeah, but still the same issues remain.
And so it's the same bottleneck.
It's the same bottleneck, yeah. And we can maybe talk about that bottleneck, yeah, a little bit at one point. But then we also said, hey, so why not taking something outside? So taking something from the patient, from the body, so cells, and manipulate them outside. Yeah. And then again, don't insert anything, just knock down something, and then give it back to the patient. Because that's something we understood we can control pretty well.
So ex vivo knockout,
vivo,
not in vivo, or in this.
So that was the one extreme, in vivo insertion, outside the liver maybe even more.
Which you are, I think, from what I understand, Crystal Therapeutics is working on it, but it's still, even today, it's still like super early.
It's super early, and that's something, if you want to talk about CRISPR, and not only CRISPR, DNA editing, maybe, yeah, RNA editing, that's something we can touch, yeah, on a little bit, because I think, as I said before, the field has been more sophisticated, but the challenges are still very, very similar, yeah, than what we have encountered 10 years ago. And so we said, okay, we combine two elements. One is knockdown, and one, the other thing, six people. Mm. And so now then look for an indication. And to be quite honest, if you have these kind of two criteria, I mean, there's not that much left, which then also fits a bill of that you want to say, okay, I want to have a reapproved consent. Yeah. I want to have something which really addresses an unmet medical need. I want to have something
where... I can't.
A market? I put this over again because it sounds a little bit, you know, yeah, I would strange because for sure we are dependent on investors, in particular at this, well, always depend on investors, but in particular in the early stage, you have private investors, so you for sure need to also bring them along. But then also how you execute our clinical trials, people forget that. You know, often, you know, they say, you know, We have an orphan indication, we have this, we have that. And so it's easy, but one has to be very careful because, you know, either a field is crowded, even an orphan indication, then it's very difficult to recruit, or you have so few patients, you know, that which are eligible to whatever protocol you have, so it might be an issue. So we said, okay, if all these criteria apply, there are not that many diseases left. And one of them was sickle cell and beta thal.
Huh.
And so,
which other gene therapy companies also work. I mean, like
Bluebird, yeah, that was an issue, quote unquote, with the investors, because the investors for sure said, can you work on hemoglobinopathy? So sickle cell and beta thal, it will be cured by Bluebird, you know? And so it was, and maybe that was something where other companies at the time, like Intellia,
yeah,
Editas, sure, they considered also hemoglobinopathies. But then, you know, maybe they got scared and said, hey, you know, how we can compete against a company and against programs which are two, three, maybe 4 years ahead. So we do something different. We wanna be differentiated this and that. And we took a different position. We said, hey, the most important thing is we wanna give this technology a chance. And so we need to de-risk it. And we want to do something where, in a field where we still feel there is an unmet medical need, despite the fact that Bluebird's program was further advanced.
Yeah.
Today, we know with hindsight that this was probably a very, very, very good decision. Yeah. You know? And it teaches you a lot of lessons. Yes.
Crazy. Because it makes me think about, we watched the interview we had in 2016 on stage in Berlin. And you were saying like that you're trying to go a bit slower, but more like a bit more conservative, but to win the race at the end and like have a more clear trajectory versus like trying to sprint and then sprint another.
It's like a marathon. It's a marathon.
And at the end, I mean, yeah, and look, 7 years later, it was the right decision, or the right pace.
I think it was the right decision. I also think that I think that's important. I think it doesn't only apply to CRISPR. CRISPR maybe is a very special case because of CRISPR editing, because all of a sudden, you know, innovation, I always say this, at least in the early days, all the innovation or most of the innovation was driven by academia.
Right.
So we could benefit from that. We all could benefit from that. So it's not like if you, let's say, have a great idea and you look for funding and you do some experiments, let's say in an academic setting, then you transfer it to a tech, to a biotech setting. Yeah. But often, you know, maybe you work with a modality, you know, which is known, but then, you know, often you're still alone with your ideas and how you make, you know, progress. And then thing in the CRISPR cases was different because so many people worked on that. It made it also more complicated for sure, because also one thing, and this is clearly a criticism, is that people, in particular the academic field, very quickly for sure realized that if you want to publish in high impact journals, you just put CRISPR in the title.
Plus cancer.
Yeah, and for CRISPR and in vivo or CRISPR and whatever kind of model. And then here we go, you have your Nature biotech paper. And like often, unfortunately, I come out of academia, but often many claims also around safety, other aspects which were made through scientific publications, I wouldn't say that they were wrong necessarily, but they were not to the standards we need in this industry, but they caused a lot of confusion with investors, even with regulators.
Yeah.
I remember many, many occasions where we had to either ignore it.
Yeah,
most of the time we tried to ignore it. Often you couldn't ignore it. And then you had to do your own work internally. So it was a very interesting time and a confusing time.
Yeah.
But the other thing, and I always refer back to my CSO at the time, Bloomberg, where a very experienced person, where I told him, listen, man, we're not in a candy store. You know, we could all look around and get nice, big, bright eyes and look, and now we could do this and we could do that. But man, the money is on hemoglobinopathy.
Yes.
We need to focus and execute on that, at least during the early years. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
You
know? Sounds like, yeah, I like that a lot. I mean, I like the fact that makes me think, I mean, everything you said, which even from an observer, it was crazy. I mean, CRISPR, I think it's the first time I see this. And I think even from reading about biotech history, I don't think this happened very often where there's so much attention and hype and money, maybe comparable to like the early days of biotech with Genentech and the like biotech factory, and it will like change everything within 10 years, and it took a bit longer. But it's amazing with CRISPR. I mean, even like, you know, even the general public knowing all about CRISPR, and sounds like even for you guys, I mean, you were basically, you had like so much possibilities, and then, but that's also what you say, it's very challenging to say no, and really focus.
I think it's a trick, and I think
And maybe also just connected to it, also you sounds like you. It's pretty clear that CRISPR was going to work, or like was like there is a huge potential.
So yes,
versus like even mRNA, even Moderna, I mean, was still very questionable if it was really going to work that big. I mean, on hindsight, it's possible, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think yes. I mean, mRNA is an interesting one. I think there's another element which. So when the very first time I joined the industry, so the biotech industry was in 2006, with Nabreva Therapeutics, which was in Austria, with a small molecule approach in antibacterials. Comparing that time to what we do today in the industry is very different from a quality perspective. I'm not saying that the companies around that time didn't meet quality criteria, but I think particularly when it comes to people, so who is working in the industry, whom can you attract, that is different. And I think that was another very, very important point that from a leadership perspective at CRISPR in the early days. So myself, I have a more of a, I would say, I'm a medic. I've been trained as a scientist for almost 10 years.
You're a professor.
Yeah, I was a professor, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, with that, you know, I always considered myself more as a translational person. So someone who sees a scientific asset and then thinks about how can you bring this into a clinical setting. You never can do this, you know? And I think what is important with these startups also at the time, that the leadership, including the CEO, unless for sure the person is able to build a different team, but I would phrase it carefully, you know, or announce,
why is the
holding back a little bit? I think it makes a huge difference for really early startups when it's about technology platforms in particular, that the leadership team in particular, also the CEO understands or has a basic understanding about what it means to bring something into the clinic. What are the potential challenges? Almost has a respect for that. Only then the individual can recruit a team really fitting the needs of the assets or the platform. And that's something I've seen repeatedly, maybe also to a certain extent with other CRISPR companies where in the early days this didn't happen. And that's something I think people and investors should really pay attention to. I mean, when you think about the leadership changes in editors, all the individuals who have been there, qualified people I respect. But when you really look back and look at, was that the really right fit for a startup in a highly competitive environment where you have all the ideas and the dreams about a game-changing technology, but in the end, it has shown nothing but some science, cell, and nature. And so I think that's very important to almost have the respect for what is about to come. And then be very smart about it and get the right team to.
And I think, makes me think that you kind of in the tech world, this experience is overrated. But I think in biotech, it's
a very good point.
Less overrated, at least than I thought.
I have a view on that. It's a very interesting, and I cannot name or mention names. That would not be correct. But I've been thinking about that question a lot, because I love to support young people, also leadership positions. I think that's absolutely important. And then more recently, you know, in a company where I'm involved, it's also a tech platform. It's stealth, so nobody can conclude anything. The person, a very smart person, who is for me, the scientific brain and founder or perceived behind this, approached me and said, hey, you know, I'm going to be the CEO. And I almost fell off my chair. Probably 10 years ago, I would have laughed him out of the room and said, ah, come on, give me a break. But then, you know, I thought about it. And it came exactly to the conclusion you just made. Because he said, in tech, we do this, and you have all these young people. I think experience, even in our industry, is to a certain extent a bit overrated, in particular when it comes to very senior people out of pharma. I mean, we should be a very dynamic environment, and I think some people probably have a challenge with that. I've been in big pharma, so I know why that is. But at the very same time, Jenny, And this is because we are, after I think the aviation industry, the most regulated industry. So it's nice to have good ideas and this and that, but you need to do this within a framework.
And even further than legal, and just the complexity of bringing a drug to the market is insane. I can even relate maybe even from like being like a bit younger than you, less experienced, and my recent experience in Switzerland with Molecular Partners, I mean, And even working in biotech, I was like, okay, I can still like, I was trying to spinning out a therapeutics company. But when I really put my hands on it, so complex. And even to see them inside trying to develop a drug, so complex. That, yeah, now it taught me this, that basically, where is the balance?
I think it's usually a balance. It's a balance. And for example, when with CRISPR, maybe briefly, but you know, I brought on board in the early days, I think after 2 years, Sam Kulkarni, who's now the CEO, for a while. And Sam was very young, and he came from McKinsey, very young. For tech, he was already an old man with his like 36 or 37.
Still 10 years of experience.
Yeah. So he had at least some exposure, but I got a lot of questions from the board, you know, because it was a C-level position, a CBO. You know, should we do this and blah 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 and so on and so forth, and I thought for sure we'd. So, I mean, it's not that young anymore, and I think the balance is the right thing to do, because also I think, in particular, when you come out of pharma and into the biotech, we can learn from people who have not been in the system. Because they come up with other ideas. And in many cases, while we develop drugs these days, in particular for rare disease, I mean, it's not in the textbook. Yeah.
That's something we could talk about. I want to continue on that, because I think you are like, what I love with you is that you have like, even when you started CRISPR Therapeutics, you had this like farm experience. This is biotech experience, very entrepreneurial mindset. And I want to like get back to that after. Okay. Like, what's the lessons there, or like a lot of things we can discuss. But going back to the actual like CRISPR therapeutic drug, one thing that even like, I mean, I have hard times to really like, you know, understand is the comparison to Bluebird on the drug. Because at the end, I mean, CRISPR, I mean, it's clear that it has changed everything in like, academic, in ag tech, in even in discovery and tools.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to actual gene therapy, I'm always wondering like, how much is it a game changer, how much improvement, and how important is the tool in the whole gene therapy approach versus a talent that is maybe a bit more expensive, maybe a bit more complicated, but from my understanding, once it's done, maybe it can do the job. But can you elaborate a bit on that? Like, yeah, for me or some similar people in the audience, and I guess you got some clinical results as well to back that up. Like,
yeah, I think when you look at CRISPR as a technology, you probably have to divide this into different pillars. You know, one pillar is, you know, more, I would almost say, as a tool in the academic world, but not only academic world, also in the CRO world. Yes. Where you, for example, use the editing to design whatever kind of animal model, whatever suits you.
And by CRISPR, it's extremely fast and cheap.
Yeah, or antibody production with cell lines. You can do a lot of stuff. Yeah. You know? What maybe for the purpose of this, I think, you know, thinking about CRISPR as a therapeutic, you know, I think when you look at this, what we have done so far, and the field has done so far, is mostly a focus on a combination of cell therapy with CRISPR technology, marrying this. So we take an HSC, so a hematopoietic stem cell, and edit that. And then the edited cell is your therapeutic. Yeah. When you think about immuno-oncology, for example, yeah, same thing. You know, you, for example, take a T cell, you design, you know, whatever kind of feature you would like to have with regard to a TCR or whatever surface antigen, yes, you name it, or you do mutations, you know, in the T cell to prevent exhaustion. Yeah, so many things. All that is very easily doable, at least at the bench with the CRISPR technology. You can, again, also reuse it for sure in the company as a tool to run our models. But then once we understand what kind of edits we have to do, for example, to have quote unquote, the very best T cell for, let's say, an immuno-oncology indication, then it becomes part of a product. So I think, and when you mentioned talents or even zinc fingers, from a single knockdown or, let's say, editing perspective, yes, they are, from a therapeutic perspective, there are indications where you absolutely could use a zinc finger or a talent. But I would call this the flexibility, the speed. Also, by now, we understand much better, from my perspective, preciseness, of doing something.
So offside.
Offside, but not, that's a very complicated matter, and I think some people would disagree with that. We don't have enough data anymore with talents and zinc finger to really come to a conclusion. But I think more that, think about small molecules. When you work on small molecules, you want to compare, lots of leads, for example, or chemical matters for a given pharmacological effect. The more you have, the more SAR you can do, the better for you. The better is it in the end to find the one molecule. The same thing is with editing. If you, in your research, have a tool in your hands where you can edit different sites, look for whatever kind of effect, biological effect, whatever it is, readouts, assays you have, and then pick, in this case, the right guide to do this, it's for sure has huge advantages over not being able to do that and rely on one or two maybe cuts or approaches. So I think this is one of the huge strengths of the technology.
But that's still more in the discovery phase, because once you're in a phase one,
sure, this is only to in the end identify your best product.
But my question then, that makes total sense, but where I'm still what's clear is then once the product is identified, Robert has a product and you go into
they're two different products, they're very different. So we have an editing product where we edit a promoter site, which leads to the upregulation of fetal hemoglobin.
Yeah.
So and Rupert does is kind of replacing a genetic default to overcome the GA defect.
Okay.
Technically, this is very different, and there are differences with regard to, and here you talked before about complexity. Complexity comes in. Manufacture. So, to manufacture what we do is only straightforward, but significantly more straightforward than, for example, what Bluebird does.
Because they also both are ex vivo.
Yeah.
They also.
Yeah. So I mean, the processes are very, very different.
Okay.
So in the end, and then also, how to put this. Best. I mean, the reason why we went after the same indication Bluebird went after was were different than they are today. At the time, we thought, it may be safer. We can produce faster. We have less variability. And these were the reasons we believed in and tried to convince the investors that this is relevant for all the reasons it might have been relevant to justify to go after what some people call the Me Too. Today, it is still totally differentiated, but for other reasons. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's also a lesson learned, if you ask me, is that if you really believe in your product, even if another company is way ahead of you and you think you can differentiate, go for it.
Yeah, she can be, let's say, best in class or
better
at the end. Yeah.
Best in class it has to be best in class, or at least, getting close to that. You need to be able to differentiate.
Yeah.
But shying away just because someone is ahead of you, in particular, if you think you maybe have better target validation or whatever you do, think about it. There are always reasons why you still could do it, but you obviously need to have a rationale for it.
It's, I mean, even just the answer to that question, it shows also the complexity behind, I mean, our discussion of complexity, and it's crazy how complex it is and how then you have to really boil down to really see like the difference.
I think it's another thing. People tend to overthink.
Yeah.
And I think keep it, even that, you have to keep it simple and you have to believe in something. Yeah. I mean, don't believe it. So that's another thing, you know, once you have made a decision for a key decision, let's say you go for an indication as a company, you have to talk to your colleagues, you're really convinced as a team, defend it, fight for it, but then also stick with it. Yeah. But you need to
work with it as long as possible until you're really wrong.
I would caveat this a little bit. Make sure that you qualify whatever you want to do as soon as possible, and you don't keep something alive for the reason or the wrong. So, I mean, everybody knows this in the industry. It's not about killing it early. That I don't like this, because you can. All these drugs, also our CRISPR drug died easily 10 times. They all die many deaths. But then again, experience tells you, can you overcome that death? Can you revive it, in one way or the other? And is it worth it? And so that is, by the way, a complexity, I think, where, again, it comes back to the earlier point I made. If you don't have a leadership, a CEO who can really also understand this and drive it, then how can that CEO who doesn't understand it stand in front of the board and say, listen, I mean, I respect you, whatever, but this is what I believe. And so I think the benefit is it's an extremely important point that particularly when it's around these complex platforms, that you have a senior team in place who understands what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's good. You could talk more about team. I think what you just said, I think the more complex something is, or even a project is, the more you need like robust team and some experience that even if you take the paradigm, I mean, launching a rocket, SpaceX, you need building.
They are not jokers.
Building a nuclear power plant or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever that, when you have a budget of a billion.
Yeah. I mean, SpaceX is a nice example. No, it's a tech example. Yeah. You have, obviously, in that case, with all respect to Elon Musk, a crazy guy with a crazy idea, but.
With the team behind the fossil.
He's not busy with the rockets. Yeah. So when you look at the team at the senior leadership, this is an A-plus team.
Yeah.
I mean, and so there's a combination of dreams, of vision, innovation, backed by professionals. And that for me is an equation which helps you, which you require for success, for brace for success.
Yeah.
Depends again how you define success, yeah. But I think this is critically important. Yeah.
I like it. So talking about this and going back to the story of like two more like less experienced founders that maybe were yet to help or executives, do you recommend them sometimes to go after something a bit less ambitious or like moonshots and something a bit more like a bit safer, less complex?
Not necessary. So first of all, moonshots, I'm not a big fan of moonshots because, because you, who was it? The Indian or the Chinese? I don't know. Someone failed right now with a landing on the moon. Anyway, no, seriously. No, I do not think so. I think we need these ideas. We need also ideas where you think totally out of the box, and where personally I even think, sometimes and often they come from people who have no exposure to the industry.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and the founder, I mean, I heard this many times also, when we did CRISPR, a founder is often not the right CEO. That very much depends. But where I am a little skeptical, and that's something maybe, I don't know if it fits the bill or the subject matter, is a difference between Europe and the US. What I have seen in Europe, not always, but there is a tendency, I would say, that academic founders, which some of them obviously very good and very interesting ideas, very much misinterpret or underestimate the challenges ahead of them, because there's one thing, for example, not only about drug development, we talked about this, there's another thing. And it also relates a little back to CRISPR. So you're now a young guy, young lady, young man, whatever, and we say, okay, I want to build a company. The problem is you need good people, because you yourself, you know, you don't know. Yeah. You know? So how do you convince people to join you? How do you make sure that people believe you, that you are the person who can lead that effort when you want to recruit the very best? It's not possible. Yeah. So why would I join someone where that person claims leadership? And I right away understand, okay, he's a very talented person, but it's nice for the ego and whatever it is to become the boss. But why would I deal with this if I have so many other opportunities? Because, you know, there are alternatives, unless that person, and that's then the difference, and maybe that's a little bit of an advice, you know, understands quickly that being the leader is primarily being also a team member. Yeah. And that what we see, I see in Europe often not at. Yeah? And the US, it's easier. Often academic founders, you know, really commission then professionals to do a bit. And with that, it's a little bit easier. Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. It's a good transition to the differences with Europe, and we can talk about the people. But I think people
it's key.
It's key.
It's everything.
It's key. Everything. So you sent me an email, I think 6 months or so, a few months ago, and you told me everything is wrong in bio in Europe besides science. We can talk about it if you want.
Hey, I was very Yeah, that's probably another search where I said, oh my God. Yeah, you want to talk about it? Yeah. Okay, I live in Europe, so I have to be careful now. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a little frustrating. You know that CRISPR is a Swiss-based company, but
in the industry. In Zug, actually.
In Zug, yeah. Yes, here, yeah. But for sure, it's almost exclusively when it comes to operations, U.S. based,
So people,
we have people at Switzerland,
mostly based.
But from an operational perspective, you know, we have our board meetings here. Key decisions are taken in Switzerland. You know, IP is all that. Yeah, it's just as important. Yeah, but operations are in Boston or at the West. That's their mission. Now, and on the one hand, when you think about recruiting, for example, at the Boston area, it's crazy because people are super expensive. You know, right now we have a different market, but, you know, during the times where biotech was booming a bit more, let's say 2 years ago, you know, we also had issues to get really qualified people, even for a company like CRISPR or other really established biotech companies, simply because people could pick and choose. Right. Yeah? But you have a market. You have very qualified people sitting in the US. They're not one American. Many of them are European working. In Europe, it's different. We have a number of challenges from my perspective or my experience. Let's start with a positive thing. I think science in Europe... Yes. Is strong.
Yeah. I saw CRISPR, Emmanuel.
That's clearly a European story. For sure, we have with Jennifer and others, you know, we have, I mean, science is international. Yeah. We have a US-American aspect, but probably a little less the way the Americans look at this. So I consider this at least the early days as a European science story. Many other things have been done in Europe. Now, the problem is how number one problem is how do you get this science translated into not only a drug, that's one thing as a job for a company, but more so, how do you sensitize, I think the right word, people, academics, to think about, hey, can I build a company? That is missing. We miss this a lot. It's getting better. Things missing. But these are not the big issues. I come to the big issues a little later. The next thing is you need to...
How long is the list?
The list is long. I try to make it shorter. The next thing's for sure, and I...
The one was the entrepreneurial mindset.
It's very,
in academia,
very different. Yeah. And it's in many ways naive, which, by the way, is not a bad thing, because what we experience in the U.S. is not very nice, because the very first, I always say, a U.S. founder always wants to see the cap table first. A European founder, in 80% of the cases, doesn't even know what the cap table is.
Yeah. So I know what it is.
Yeah, because what is it? Now, and I like the European approach much more, not because then we can take advantage of the naivety, not at all.
Because you focus on the science.
But you focus on the assets, you focus on the science. But the entrepreneurial mind is different. Also, a respect for what we do and what we in this industry is very different. I think maybe less than 10, 15 years ago, but I was still in academia where it was considered, you were considered a failure if you entered the industry. Yeah. And I think this mindset is still there. Yeah. So that's one thing, yeah? But then coming back to the very early subject, we had team and people, to find European leadership, CEOs in particular, but also chief business officers, is hard. It's very, very hard. Not that we don't have them. Many of them are in the U.S., and we do have some, but we can probably, I would say, count them on one hand, but maybe two and a half hands, I don't know, are sufficient when it comes not to startups. I mean, this is, again, a slightly different game, but when it comes to people with real experience...
Other watchers, like that.
No, yeah, but
seem to say having a little. Yeah.
My background, you know, academic background, medical doctor, but many years in biotech, pharma, you know, two Nasdaq listed companies, you name it, yeah, long time or a lot of experience with investors, being bankers, be it VCs, you name it, in the U.S. You find, let's put it on the table, you find a lot of odd guests, a lot of there. In Europe, yes, we have them, not that many. And that's a challenge. Yeah, because we need them. We need these people. Yeah, and not at my stage, well, at the stage of my career or end of my career or whatever you want to put this, yeah. But at least some of that where we can really help these companies move on, because we have another challenge in Europe and we can't change that. We don't have a Nasdaq. And so that's a tricky thing, because in the end, we always have to focus at one point to the US, a different models to do that. But actually IPOing a company is one of the key exits for investors. Yes, you have M&A and all that, but I don't know what the numbers are, but I do believe that an IPO right now, so that's more tricky, obviously, but it will come back, you know, is one of the key exits, which also, again, attracts, obviously, investors when they see an opportunity. And if you are on a continent which doesn't allow you, for sure, you can go on you know, local exchange, what is the right word?
Stock market.
But in most instances, at least for the biotech industry, be some exceptions, but so you have to be listed at NASDAQ.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, you need to have a presence there. You need to not just fly over sometimes and meet some bankers or analysts. You need to have some center of gravitas, which then moves attention away from your European side. Mm. So it's doable, but it makes it more, you know.
Always surprised me to the stock market in Europe, but even for biotech, there's just not a like more European stock market. It's crazy. But I mean, that's that. Everything you mentioned also, then it's like, I mean, it's really on the structural level, on the like on top level. Like, I mean, obviously you will not change that, but like how to really change these things?
I don't know. I mean, it's. I mean, obviously, stock exchange. That was a word. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's super hard, and I don't know. I think it's almost impossible. But when we look at our industry, not only biotech industry, European industry. For sure, there are pockets where we have tech industry and all that. But I do think we do have a different mentality. It's not bad, but I think our mentality is different. But it's certainly also in other areas much less entrepreneurial. And I think over time, that's almost prohibitive when we think about, you know, what is the future? How do we manage this? How do we encourage people to take their life and their responsibility in their own hands and not be too afraid of the risk, because for sure there is risk. It's an economic risk.
You're talking quite a lot on the like also kind of micro society level across countries. Maybe if you look at it more from a micro level, let's say whatever, founder or CEO is 35, 40, based in Europe, what can he or she do about it? Because I think that's also, because I mean, basically a very stoic way of seeing it, like what's in my control, what's not in my control, and just I do what is in my control. Same as you when you started Christotherapeutics, you and Sean and Emmanuel, but when you started Christotherapeutics, you realized early on, Switzerland is not enough. Let's go to Boston, IPO directly on NASDAQ, you never IPO'd on the European market. I think if I'm sure,
yeah, yeah, that's correct.
Most of the team, they're Europeans, but they're all US-based Europeans. I mean, there were decisions that were basically in your control.
Yes.
And a European founder CEO could go after the same decisions. Like,
absolutely. Yeah.
But I'm curious how you, like, is there something more there you would see? Like, I mean, giving that the macro, understanding the macro, and then how can you apply to you or whoever is listening, let's say a founder, a CEO, even an investor, how can they apply their micro understanding to a micro, like what's in their control decision?
Difficult.
Because that's actionable.
Yeah. I mean, my view is maybe an example. I work as a venture partner for SR1, which is a US VC group, obviously
from
the past, from GSK, yeah. But they're independent now, they're raised now, they're very successful. I think they're the second fund, and they have a European presence in the UK. I always, when you look at, you know, when you look, how they look at European companies, startup companies, I often have the impression they look at them differently as if they looked at the US. And so an actual item, for example, for investors, just take investors, is can they trust these guys? Trust also the younger people, encourage them, you know, don't have different kind of perspectives just because it's a European team.
Yeah,
yeah, things like that. But in the end, it comes down to ourselves as Europeans. And one thing is, from my perspective, very, very clear, we need to be a bit more brave.
Yeah.
We need to accept that failure is part of the journey. And also understand that it's not about you. yeah, you could argue Americans are, you know, they think it's about them, but they're smart enough to understand, you know, I can only win at the team. Yeah, I'm not saying they're necessarily better team players, but I think that there is more tradition to this, to understand, hey, I cannot do this alone. Yeah. And with that, I think the system is a bit more, you know.
What I like, for example, if I look at myself, what I quite like is, I mean, I would basically agree with everything you said, and it comes from whatever. I lived a bit in Boston and working, but once, for me, what I like is once I have this like macro understanding, then translating it at a micro level. And what I mean, for example, at a micro level, I will work only with Europeans based in Europe who have understood this.
Mm-hmm.
For example, or like most, and so, I mean, it's not, but yep, usually it is the case. And so, for example, a French who doesn't speak English, I will never work with him. Like very, very rarely a German who doesn't speak English, because if you don't even work in English.
Oh, yeah, sure.
For example, but you can already filter out like a lot of people actually.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were not this the best fit, and it's not the best fit for me as well.
Yeah.
Maybe they're a good fit for others, or like, I tried when I was looking for academic co-founder before going to Micro Partners, and I talked to like 16 of them. 15 of them, after 2 minutes, I wanted to stop the conversation.
Yeah, they only talk about themselves, no?
No, that's my experience. Themselves, and they had like zero understanding of what like company building was even about. What, so it's like zero, not even like, you know, being experts. They're not
meant to be experts. From my perspective, one of the key issues we have in Europe, the people really, not, I shouldn't say the people, because there are always exceptions and fantastic people, but if you look at the majority, and I'm talking, maybe that's too much, 90% on the academics. I have to say that with all respect, sitting in the ivory tower, they have no respect. They have no respect for what is outside, and that they're, you know, I joined just recently, last year, end of last year, the Nobel Prize ceremony with Emmanuel as a special guest. So I had the privilege to be pretty much at all festivities, events, you name it. After a week, you know, I said, oh man, it was a life, once in a lifetime experience, for sure, meeting the king, But then, you know, I said, you know, wow, these people only talk about themselves. You know, for example, CRISPR, which was probably a pretty special Nobel Prize because it was given early, it was given to two ladies, and it was actually already translated into something, which was, by the way, the purpose of Nobel, you know, creates a value for the society.
Yeah.
You know, so not a freaking single word about this. I was just sitting there. I was thinking sometimes, I mean, you're all probably bright people, but your horizon stops very close to your nose, you know, to the tip of your nose, at the tip of your nose. And it was very enjoyable. Yeah, it's not that. But they should open up because we could meet their help.
Yeah.
When I talk, and Emmanuel will forgive me for that. Forgive me that. Hopefully, you know, when I talk to Emmanuel about what we do at CRISPR, what can you do with the CRISPR technology, let's say in immunology or whatever it is, it's not a lot. Yeah. I'm not even talking about Jennifer Doudna, who stands up at the Nobel Prize ceremony and says, we need to do more with CRISPR because so far very little has happened. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? And what are you talking about? And I think in particular in European academia, the respect and the understanding of the relevance, even from a scientific perspective, of this industry is almost not existing. And that's a huge issue because without the innovation out of academia, I mean, at least in the startup phase, we're lost. Yeah. And I have a lot of examples with academic funds where, similar to your experience, where I say today, not having seen a few, I'm not working with them, period.
Yeah.
I need to be 5 minutes in a room, or let's say half an hour. It's very clear,
yeah,
because they only consider their science. They often don't even know the science in a broader perspective. They think this is a way to get wealthy. This is not a way to get wealthy. This is a way to have an impact and to change something, you know, with respect to the benefit of
and to use the science.
Yeah. If you want to get wealthy or famous, well, then do something else. Go on a sitcom. Yeah. I mean, this is crazy. Yeah. And so that's something that is a totally wrong perspective about this industry among many, many European academics. And I find this is a pity. It's a real pity.
I hope academics are watching us. But coming back to what you just said as well, like, I mean, you understand it on the micro level, but what can you do on the micro level? It's a bit like harder, but on the micro level, even for you, you know rapidly what kind of scientists you want to work with, and you will just...
You can build companies, by the way.
Yeah.
So we are doing this right now. Two, I think, are in the building. We might even...
In that building?
No, in the building, not in this one. In the building. In this,
like, I lie on my... To be honest, by the way, exactly.
No, in this building. So we are currently building that.
And
I think it's absolutely doable. But it's harder. It's more difficult, you know. And then that does have to do for sure. Not only, I mean, we cannot blame everything on academia in Europe, yeah. But it has to do with the mindset, which is not only, and this is important. I mean, if an academic founder has a, let's say, bit different mindset, fine, okay. That is not prohibitive for building a company. It just makes it more annoying, yeah. What is a problem that many of the ideas we see never go anywhere because of, you know, whatever kind of attitude. What is, I think, more difficult is in Europe is that it's not only academia which has this,
yeah.
It's also us as Europeans, we do not respect entrepreneurship the way Americans respect it. And so even at the level of, for sure, we get good scientists. I mean, we have no issues to get good scientists in Europe, yeah. But still, you know, you want to have also people who might interact at the more senior level with the investors. This is more difficult. And the reason why it's more difficult, you have less people who have done it. And there are less people simply also in the pool because it's not viewed necessarily as, oh, wow, this is something you should do. I have a super nice example. About 10 years ago, still longer now, 85 years ago, I had a birthday party. And a very good friend comes to me and he says, Otka, I need to talk to you. I said, sure. No, already having some beers. So no, it was good.
Yeah, but
he said, what's up? He said, you know what? I don't understand what you're doing. I was at that time, I was at Sanofi. You're not a manager. Yeah, you are an MD. Why don't you work? He is an MD. Why don't you work as a medical doctor? You should not be in this industry. So I don't understand it, you know? And so I found this a little strange, you know, it was a job, you know? But then when I left, say, Sanofi, I was a global head at Effective, so a very secure, nice position, and started with CRISPR. I would say 90%, if people cared, most people anyway don't care, that's fine. 90% who thought they care or thought they have to comment told me, nuts, what are you doing? You know, I mean, and yeah, it's probably a justified question, but in the US, I wouldn't get that question. People would say, oh my God, how did you come across that?
How can I invest?
Yeah. And we say, oh, are you crazy? Why do you do this? You know, you can't do this. Oh my God, you know, you have this nice company car, you have you have your shares, you have this, and you live in a in middle of Paris in the Marais. The company pays you the apartment. I mean, you're almost God. So why do you do this?
What?
And in the US, people tell you, oh my God, what a great opportunity. Oh, it's fantastic. You know, tell me about it. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. Yeah. It's a big difference.
It's different. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. At the end, I think you don't regret the decision.
I don't know. I don't regret the decision, but I think it's yeah, it's sometimes even at a personal level, sometimes difficult because I live in Europe now. I have a twin brother, identical twin, and smart cookie. And he decided to, you know, have a career in big corporate. Yeah, you know? So he was at a big international insurance. I would clearly say that my brother, who's my twin brother, identical twin, was pretty close to me, does not understand what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's just an example, although he's close to me. I have a lot of friends or people I know really well in the US who know what I'm doing and not only out of the industry, who have a curiosity to understand what this is. In Europe? Europe? Oh, the guy made some money. That's not. Yeah. Oh. You know, maybe, you know, he has two apartments. That's a lot. Yeah.
Or is it just
I mean, you have to, in Europe, you have to justify yourself. You have to justify yourself for what you did. And in particular, if you have been successful. Yeah. And I think going back to our subject matter, when you think about being an entrepreneur, that's totally prohibitive. Because for sure, entrepreneurship has to do with risk, it has to do with independence, it has to do also with innovation, yeah, and all these aspects. And I don't think that, I think that many Europeans do not really understand and how important it is for our society.
Yeah. What I like in your example is, you cannot... And that's also what makes us European. I mean, your family is European or some people close, and that's how it's not that much in your control versus, your friend group is more in your control.
But yes.
Even for me, I mean, I just met my dad. It took him a long time to understand what I was doing at the biotech. Do something in bed. But at some point, okay, it's working, we're profitable, 10 employees. Oh, okay.
Okay, it's good. At least secure. There's a job.
Even now, it's like, okay.
You know, I don't have a specialization in medicine, yeah. So I don't have what we call in German Facharzt, yeah, because I went into the industry and my parents, still way into the CRISPR story, asked me, how and do you finish that, you know? It's crazy, yeah? or another example, and I think it does fit for sure. It's not tech. I have a cousin. He's much younger than me. And he has probably some boring job. I'm not exactly sure what he does, but also something with an insurance company. And all of a sudden, I see on Insta that he has a food truck. Yeah, so he now, I think it's part-time, has a food truck. So I right away text him. What is that? People say, hey, cool, you know, that's great, whatever. And others say, oh, why is he doing? Can he make some money with that? Yeah. And I think, hey, that is Europe. Yeah. It's always someone does something a little different. That's weird, you know. That makes sense. And I think we should be more open. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then if we do something, we should also push for it and be serious about it. We are not playing around. You're not playing around with your company. I'm not playing around with my company. We are dead serious, yeah. But we do it in a different context. And I think we deserve, not that I look for respect, I couldn't care less to be quite honest, but I think this deserves respect. Yeah. And you don't get it because people in most instances haven't had the exposure, yeah. And so that I think is, if you think about Europe, the US, biotech, investors, NASDAQ, non-NASDAQ, that's one of our issues.
No, it's a good one. I mean, on the positive side, I think it's changing. And actually, I'm positively surprised by how rapidly it's changing.
It changes. I agree with that.
10 years. And And I feel like there's a lot of variation between the countries. When it comes to them in the UK, they're definitely like ahead. In South, like Berlin is the figure.
And I think the pure tech thing is also better.
And tech,
that, yeah. I think I see this, you know, because I get now often approached because of AI.
Yeah.
I'm totally clueless, you know. I'm thinking I totally believe that AI will have also our industry huge impact. I just don't know how, and I particularly don't know who. Yeah, because I just don't fully get it. Don't get it at all. But I think our industry in particular is, and we have another problem, Vinci. We have one problem that's economic.
We have 5 minutes left.
Okay. You can count this all out. But that's an important, it's about economics. Yeah. Our industry, even the biotech industry, has a bad reputation, a particular bad reputation in Europe. And I think for some good reasons, the behavior of pharma, the communication style of pharma, I think also that's getting a little better, but man, you know, if I wouldn't be in that industry, I wouldn't like it either, to be quite honest. Once people understand, you work on drugs, you're pharma. But we're not pharma.
Yeah.
Yeah? And that's something also maybe us as representatives of the industry, biotech industry, need to be. We're not.
Yeah. That's a good one. I think we can finish on this. Thanks a lot, Roger, for joining in.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, we could talk longer and longer. Maybe if people want to follow you, to know more about you, you're on some social media.
Not really.
I'm more Instagram.
I stay away from this now. No, I don't do anything on social media. I'm on LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn.
I think. Sometimes I update it, sometimes. But yeah,
they can't wait for. I mean, you're talking publicly from time to time. Heather, yes. You did Heather to Top, Heather Tomorrow. You were on the. Actually, I forgot to mention. Actually, on the biotech Between the Biotech Waves podcast with Sean. Yeah.
Nessun Birmingham.
Nessun. And actually, it's a great episode. And for people who want to know the backstory, the behind the story for the early days. And also, you came twice to Labiotech Refresh, and once 2016, once 2019-20. Also great, like, background. So for the ones listening who wants to go deeper from that episode, you can, I will link I will put all the links in the description.
So now I need to leave Europe, you know.
No, you need to help. Yeah, on the positive side, you showed that it was possible to bring amazing science, and right now you are also explaining what's wrong. Now people can work on it, and you're also supporting European funds, entrepreneurs.
Yes, sure.
You're not board members, so like, I think, I mean, it sounds maybe a bit negative to describe the problem, but I think what I like is that you're really doing something about it and you're helping others do something about it. And that's
one of the reasons I came back from the US was because of European culture.
And
what I really refer to is the entrepreneurs, in particular in maybe an industry which is not well understood. That's, from my perspective, a problem. And then also academia, but academia, I think the general aspect of academia, it's the same. US, Europe, I mean, this kind of, I call this, to a certain extent, arrogancy, you know? But then the US Americans, again, are more entrepreneurial. In that case, probably more driven by economics and cap tables, which I don't like so much. And the Europeans less so, also because they know less. They know less about that system. And so that's something I think with education and good examples. So it's much better today than obviously 10 years ago. But I just said recently an experience with.
That's when you send me the email.
Probably. That's all mine.
All right. Thanks, Roger.
Okay. Thank you.
Me again. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and thanks a lot for listening to the end. If you're keen, please hit the follow button somewhere, maybe, or the like, review, share button, share it with some connections. It would help us a lot, especially this early in the show. And before telling you more what's behind the show, I want to say big kudos and thanks to the team. Kieran, web development, Taswin in marketing, Marianne logistics, Wayne in editing, they did an amazing job. And there's a lot of hard work put into the show. So now, what's behind? So SlotBio, the company was founded in March 2022. I'm one of the founder, and previously I founded LabBiotech.eu. And we started the company building a marketplace for the biotech industry, but we didn't have enough product market fit. So we decided to pivot to a content business, with the first product being the podcast. We don't want to create, you know, yet another podcast. There's already a lot of them around. But we believe Europe needs a high quality, long form podcast to help both professionals and biotech enthusiasts be better informed, grow, and just be better at what they're doing. And so that's why we are creating that podcast. We are selecting the best UPs in biotech we can find, and we are interviewing mostly actually offline, so we can have really the highest quality, both technical aspect, but most importantly on the dance and the content and the flow of the interview content. We release one episode per month on all the major platforms. Money wise, we are financed by our own private investments, and our business model is based on advertisement. So it's the sponsored messages, slots that you see in each episode, and we are sponsored by financial support for individuals and corporate. So anyway, I will not make it longer. I hope you share our vision, and if you're keen to hear more, or you want to reach out, or you want to share some feedback, please shoot us an email, hi@flot.bio. Again, thanks for listening, and see you in the next episode. Bye.